Erna takes away the food. Suddenly my mother seizes hold of my hand and asks falteringly, "Was it very bad out there, Paul?" Mother, what should I answer to that? You would not understand, you could never realize it, and you shall never realize it. Was it bad, you ask? You, mother. I shake my head and say, "No, mother, not so very. There are always a lot of us together, so it isn't so bad." "Yes, but Heinrich Bredemeyer was here just lately and said it was terrible out there now with the gas and all the rest of it." It is my mother who says that. She says, "with the gas and all the rest of it." She does not know what she is saying. She is merely anxious for me. Should I tell her how we once found three enemy trenches with their garrison all stiff as though stricken with apoplexy, against the parapet, in the dugouts, just where they were, the men stood and lay about with blue faces, dead? "No, mother, that's only talk," I answer. "There's not very much in what Bredemeyer says. You see, for instance, I'm well and fit." Before my mother's tremulous anxiety, I recover my composure. Now I can walk about and talk and answer questions without fear of having suddenly to lean against the wall because the world turns soft as rubber and my veins become brimstone. My mother wants to get up, so I go for a while to my sister in the kitchen. "What is the matter with her?" I ask. She shrugs her shoulders. "She has been in bed some months now, but we did not want to write and tell you. Several doctors have been to see her. One of them said it is probably cancer again." I go to the district commandant to report myself. Slowly I wander through the streets. Occasionally someone speaks to me. I do not delay long, for I have little inclination to talk. On the way back from the barracks, a loud voice calls out to me. Still lost in thought, I turn round and find myself confronted by a major. "Can't you salute?" he blusters. "Sorry, Major," I say in embarrassment, "I didn't notice you." "Don't you know how to speak properly?" he roars. I would like to hit him in the face, but control myself, for my leave depends on it. I click my heels and say, "I did not see you, Herr Major."
"Then keep your eyes open," he snorts. "What is your name?"
I give it. His fat, red face is furious.
"What regiment?"
I give him full particulars. Even yet he has not had enough.
"Where are you quartered?"
But I have had more than enough, and say, "Between Langemark and Bixschoote."
"Eh?"
he asks, a bit stupefied. I explain to him that I arrived on leave only an hour or two since, thinking that he would then trot along. But not at all. He gets even more furious.
"You think you can bring your front-line manners here, what? Well, we don't stand for that sort of thing. Thank God we have discipline here. 20 paces backwards, double march,"
he commands. I am mad with rage, but I cannot say anything to him. He could put me under arrest if he liked. So I double back and then march up to him. 6 paces from him, I spring to a stiff salute and maintain it until I am 6 paces beyond him. He calls me back again, and affably gives me to understand that for once he is pleased to put mercy before justice. I pretend to be duly grateful.
"Now dismiss," he says.
I turn about smartly and march off. That ruins the evening for me. I go back home and throw my uniform into a corner. I had intended to change it in any case. Then I take out my civilian clothes from the wardrobe and put them on. I feel awkward. The suit is rather tight and short. I have grown in the army. Collar and tie give me some trouble. In the end, my sister ties the bow for me. But how light the suit is! It feels as though I had nothing on but a shirt and underpants. I look at myself in the glass. It is a strange sight. A sunburnt, overgrown candidate for confirmation gazes at me in astonishment. My mother is pleased to see me wearing civilian clothes. It makes me less strange to her. But my father would rather I kept my uniform on so that he could take me to visit his acquaintances. But I refuse. It is pleasant to sit quietly somewhere, in the beer garden, for example, under the chestnuts by the skittle alley. The leaves fall down on the table and on the ground, only a few, the first. A glass of beer stands in front of me. I've learned to drink in the army. The glass is half empty, but there are a few good swigs ahead of me. And besides, I can always order a second and a third if I wish to. There are no bugles and no bombardments. The children of the house play in the skittle alley, and the dog rests his head against my knee. The sky is blue. Between the leaves of the chestnuts rises the green spire of St. Margaret's Church. This is good. I like it. But I cannot get on with the people. My mother is the only one who asks no questions. Not so my father. He wants me to tell him about the front. He is curious in a way that I find stupid and distressing. I no longer have any real contact with him. There is nothing he likes more than just hearing about it. I realize he does not know that a man cannot talk of such things. I would do it willingly, but it is too dangerous for me to put these things into words. I am afraid they might then become gigantic, and I be no longer able to master them. What would become of us if everything that happens out there were quite clear to us? So I confine myself to telling him a few amusing things. But he wants to know whether I've ever had a hand-to-hand fight. I say no, and get up and go out. But that does not mend matters. After I've been startled a couple of times in the street by the screaming of the tram cars, which resembles the shriek of a shell coming straight for one, somebody taps me on the shoulder. It is my German master, and he fastens on me with the usual question. Well, how are things out there? Terrible, terrible, eh? Yes, it is dreadful. But we must carry on. And after all, you do at least get decent food out there, so I hear. You look well, Paul, and fit. Naturally, it's worse here, naturally. The best for our soldiers every time, that goes without saying. He drags me along to a table with a lot of others. They welcome me. The headmaster shakes hands with me and says, "So, you come from the front. What is the spirit like out there? Excellent, huh? Excellent?" I explain that no one would be sorry to be back home. He laughs uproariously. "I can well believe it, but first you have to give the froggies a good hiding. Do you smoke? Here, try one. Waiter, bring a beer as well for our young warrior." Unfortunately, I have accepted the cigar, so I have to remain. And they are all so dripping with goodwill that it is impossible to object. All the same, I feel annoyed and smoke like a chimney as hard as I can. In order to make at least some show of appreciation, I toss off the beer in one gulp. Immediately a second is ordered. People know how much they are indebted to the soldiers. They argue about what we ought to annex. The headmaster with the steel watch chain wants to have at least the whole of Belgium, the coal areas of France, and a slice of Russia. He produces reasons why we must have them, and is quite inflexible until at last the others give in to him. Then he begins to expound just whereabouts in France the breakthrough must come, and turns to me. "Now, shove ahead a bit out of there with your everlasting trench warfare, smash through the Johnnies, and then there will be peace." I reply that in our opinion a breakthrough may not be possible. The enemy may have too many reserves. Besides, the war may be rather different from what people think. He dismisses the idea loftily and informs me I know nothing about it. "The details, yes," says he, "but this relates to the whole, and of that you are not able to judge. You see only your little sector and so cannot have any general survey. You do your duty, you risk your lives, that deserves the highest honor. Every man of you ought to have the Iron Cross. But first of all, the enemy line must be broken through in Flanders, and then rolled up from the top." He blows his nose and wipes his beard. "Completely rolled up they must be, from the top to the bottom, and then to Paris." I would like to know just how he pictures it to himself, and pour the third glass of beer into me. Immediately he orders another. But I break away. He stuffs a few more cigars into my pocket and sends me off with a friendly slap. "All of the best. I hope we will soon hear something worthwhile from you." I imagined leave would be different from this. Indeed, it was different a year ago. It is I, of course, that have changed in the interval. There lies a gulf between that time and today. At that time, I still knew nothing about the war. We had only been in quiet sectors. But now I see that I have been crushed without knowing it. I find I do not belong here anymore. It is a foreign world. Some of these people ask questions, some ask no questions, but one can see that the latter are proud of themselves for their silence. They often say with a wise air that these things cannot be talked about. They plume themselves on it. I prefer to be alone, so that no one troubles me. For they all come back to the same thing, how badly it goes and how well it goes. One thinks it is this way, another that. And yet they are always absorbed in the things that go to make up their existence. Formerly I lived in just the same way myself, but now I feel no contact here. They talk too much for me. They have worries, aims, desires that I cannot comprehend. I often sit with one of them in the little beer garden and try to explain to him that this is really the only thing, just to sit quietly like this. They understand, of course, they agree. They may even feel it so, too. But only with words, only with words. Yes, that is it. They feel it, but always with only half of themselves. The rest of their being is taken up with other things. They are so divided in themselves that none feels it with his whole essence. I cannot even say myself exactly what I mean. When I see them here in their rooms, in their offices, about their occupations, I feel an irresistible attraction in it. I would like to be here too and forget the war. But also it repels me. It is so narrow. How can that fill a man's life? He ought to smash it to bits. How can they do it while out at the front the splinters are whining over the shell holes and star shells go up, the wounded are carried back on waterproof sheets, and comrades crouch in the trenches? They are different men here, men I cannot properly understand, whom I envy and despise. I must think of Kat and Albert and Müller and Tjaden. What will they be doing? No doubt they are sitting in the canteen or perhaps swimming. Soon they will have to go up to the front line again. In my room behind the table stands a brown leather sofa. I sit down on it. On the walls are pinned countless pictures that I once used to cut out of the newspapers. In between are drawings and postcards that have pleased me. In the corner is a small iron stove. Against the wall opposite stand the bookshelves with my books. I used to live in this room before I was a soldier. The books I bought gradually with the money I earned by coaching. Many of them are second-hand. All the classics, for example, one volume in blue cloth boards cost 1 mark 20 pfennig. I bought them complete because it was thoroughgoing. I did not trust the editors of selections to choose all the best, so I purchased only collected works. I read most of them with laudable zeal, but few of them really appealed to me. I preferred the other books, the moderns, which were, of course, much dearer. A few I came by, not quite honestly. I borrowed and did not return them, because I did not want to part with them. One shelf is filled with schoolbooks. They are not so well cared for. They are badly thumbed, and pages have been torn out for certain purposes. Then below are periodicals, papers, and letters all jammed in together with drawings and rough sketches. I want to think myself back into that time. It is still in the room. I feel it at once. The walls have preserved it. My hands rest on the arms of the sofa. Now I make myself at home and draw up my legs so that I sit comfortably in the corner, in the arms of the sofa. The little window is open. Through it I see the familiar picture of the street with the rising spire of the church at the end. There are a couple of flowers on the table, pen holders, a shell as a paperweight, the inkwell. Here nothing has changed. It will be like this, too. If I am lucky when the war is over and I come back here for good, I will sit here just like this and look at my room and wait. I feel excited, but I do not want to be, for that is not right. I want that quiet rapture again. I want to feel the same powerful, nameless urge that I used to feel when I turned to my books. The breath of desire that then arose from the colored backs of the books shall fill me again, melt the heavy, dead lump of lead that lies somewhere in me, and waken again the impatience of the future, the quick joy in the world of thought. It shall bring back again the lost eagerness of my youth. I sit and wait. It occurs to me that I must go and see Kamerick's mother. I might visit Mittelstädt, too. He should be at the barracks. I look out of the window. Beyond the picture of the sunlit street appears a range of hills, distant and light. It changes to a clear day in autumn, and I sit by the fire with Kat and Albert and eat potatoes baked in their skins. But I do not want to think of that. I sweep it away. The room shall speak. It must catch me up and hold me. I want to feel that I belong here. I want to hearken and know when I go back to the front that the war will sink down, be drowned utterly in the great homecoming tide. Know that it will then be past forever and not gnaw us continually, that it will have none but an outward power over us. The backs of the books stand in rows. I know them all still. I remember arranging them in order. I implore them with my eyes, speak to me, take me up, take me, life of my youth, you who are carefree, beautiful, receive me again. I wait, I wait. Images float through my mind, but they do not grip me. They are mere shadows and memories. Nothing. Nothing. My disquietude grows. A terrible feeling of foreignness suddenly rises up in me. I cannot find my way back. I am shut out, though I entreat earnestly and put forth all my strength. Nothing stirs. Listless and wretched, like a condemned man, I sit there, and the past withdraws itself. And at the same time I fear to importune it too much, because I do not know what might happen then. I am a soldier. I must cling to that. Wearily I stand up and look out of the window. Then I take one of the books, intending to read and turn over the leaves. But I put it away and take out another. There are passages in it that have been marked. I look, turn over the pages, take up fresh books. Already they are piled up beside me. Speedily more join the heap, papers, magazines, letters. I stand there, dumb, as before a judge, dejected. Words, words, words. They do not reach me. Slowly I place the books back in the shelves. Nevermore. Quietly I go out of the room. Still I do not give up hope. I do not indeed go to my room anymore, but comfort myself with the thought that a few days are not enough to judge by. Afterwards, later on, there is plenty of time for that. So I go over to see Mittelstädt in the barracks, and we sit in his room. There is an atmosphere about it that I do not like, but with which I am quite familiar. Mittelstädt has some news ready for me that electrifies me on the spot. He tells me Cantorek has been called up as a territorial.
Just think of it,
says he, and takes out a couple of good cigars. I come back here from the hospital and bump right into him. He stretches out his paw to me and bleats, "Hello, Mittelstädt, how are you?" I look at him and say, "Territorial Cantorek. Business is business, and schnapps is schnapps. You ought to know that well enough. Stand to attention when you speak to a superior officer." You should have seen his face, a cross between a dud and a pickled cucumber. He tried once again to chum up, so I snubbed him a bit harder. Then he brought up his biggest guns and asked confidentially, "Would you like me to use my influence so that you can take an emergency exam?" He was trying to remind me of those things, you know. Then I got mad, and I reminded him of something instead. "Territorial Cantorek, 2 years ago, you preached us into enlisting, and among us there was one, Joseph Bame, who didn't want to enlist. He was killed 3 months before he would have been called up in the ordinary way. If it had not been for you, he would have lived just that much longer. And now, dismiss. You will hear from me later." It was easy to get put in charge of his company. First thing I did was to take him to the stores and fit him out with suitable equipment. You will see in a minute. We go to the parade ground. The company has fallen in. Mittelstädt stands them at ease and inspects. Then I see Cantorek, and I'm scarcely able to stifle my laughter. He is wearing a faded blue tunic. On the back and in the sleeves there are big dark patches. The tunic must have belonged to a giant. The black, worn breeches are just as much too short. They reach barely halfway down his calf. The boots, tough old clodhoppers with turned-up toes and laces at the side, are much too big for him. But as a compensation, the cap is too small, a terribly dirty, mean little pillbox. The whole rig-out is just pitiful. Mittelstädt stops in front of him. "Territorial Cantorek, do you call those buttons polished? You seem as though you can never learn." "Inadequate, Cantorek, quite inadequate." It makes me bubble with glee. In school, Cantorek used to chasten Mittelstädt with exactly the same expression. "Inadequate, Mittelstädt, quite inadequate." Mittelstädt continues to upbraid him. "Look at Böttcher now. There's a model for you to learn from." I can hardly believe my eyes. Böttcher is there, too. Böttcher, our school porter. And he is a model. Cantorek shoots a glance at me as if he would like to eat me, but I grin at him innocently, as though I do not recognize him anymore. Nothing could look more ludicrous than his forage cap and his uniform. And this is the object before whom we used to stand in anguish as he sat up there enthroned at his desk, spearing at us with his pencil for our mistakes in those irregular French verbs with which afterwards we made so little headway in France. That is barely 2 years ago, and now here stands Territorial Cantorek, the spell quite broken, with bent knees, arms like pothooks, unpolished buttons, and that ludicrous rig-out, an impossible soldier. I cannot reconcile this with the menacing figure at the schoolmaster's desk. I wonder what I, the old soldier, would do if this skinful of woe ever dared to say to me again, "Boyma, give me the imperfect of Allez!" Then Mittelstädt makes them practice skirmishing, and as a favor appoints Cantorek squad leader. Now, in skirmishing, the squad leader has always to keep 20 paces in front of his squad. If the order comes, "On the march about, turn," the line of skirmishers simply turns about, but the squad leader, who now finds himself suddenly 20 paces in the rear of the line, has to rush up at the double and take his position again 20 paces in front of the squad. That makes altogether 40 paces double march. But no sooner has he arrived than the order, "On the march, about turn," comes again, and he once more has to race at top speed another 40 paces to the other side. In this way the squad has merely made the turnabout and a couple of paces, while the squad leader dashes backwards and forwards like a fart on a curtain pole. That is one of Himmelstoss's well-worn recipes. Cantorek can hardly expect anything else from Mittelstädt, for he once messed up the latter's chance of promotion, and Mittelstädt would be a big fool not to make the best of such a good opportunity as this before he goes back to the front again. A man might well die easier after the army has given him just one such stroke of luck. In the meantime, Kantorek is dashing up and down like a wild boar. After a while, Mittelstädt stops the skirmish and begins the very important exercise of creeping. On hands and knees, carrying his gun in regulation fashion, Kantorek shoves his absurd figure over the sand immediately in front of us. He is breathing hard, and his panting is music. Mittelstädt encourages Kantorek the Territorial with quotations from Kantorek the Schoolmaster. "Territorial Kantorek, we have the good fortune to live in a great age. We must brace ourselves and triumph over hardship." Kantorek sweats and spits out a dirty piece of wood that has lodged in his teeth. Mittelstädt stoops down and says reproachfully, "And in the trifles, never lose sight of the great adventure, Territorial Kantorek." It amazes me that Kantorek does not explode with a bang, especially when, during physical exercises, Mittelstädt copies him to perfection, seizing him by the seat of his trousers as he is pulling himself up on the horizontal bar so that he can just raise his chin above the beam, and then starts to give him good advice. That is exactly what Kantorek used to do to him at school. The extra fatigues are next detailed off. "Kantorek and Bitcher, bread fatigue. Take the handcart with you." A few minutes later, the two set off together, pushing the barrow. Kantorek, in a fury, walks with his head down, but the porter is delighted to have scored light duty. The bakehouse is away at the other end of the town, and the two must go there and back through the whole length of it. "They've done that a couple of times already," grins Mittelstädt. "People have begun to watch for them coming." "Excellent," I say. "But hasn't he reported you yet?" "He did try. Our CO laughed like the deuce when he heard the story. He hasn't any time for schoolmasters. Besides, I'm sweet with his daughter. They'll mess up the examination for you." "I don't care," says Mittelstädt calmly. "Besides, his complaint came to nothing, because I could show that he had had hardly anything but light duty." "Couldn't you polish him up a bit?" I ask. "He's too stupid. I couldn't be bothered," answers Mittelstädt contemptuously. What is leave? A pause that only makes everything after it so much worse. Already the sense of parting begins to intrude itself. My mother watches me silently. I know she counts the days. Every morning she is sad. It is one day less. She has put away my pack. She does not want to be reminded by it. The hours pass quickly if a man broods. I pull myself together and go with my sister to the slaughterhouse to get a pound or two of bones. That is a great favor, and people line up early in the morning and stand waiting. Many of them faint. We have no luck. After waiting by turns for 3 hours, the queue disperses. The bones have not lasted out. It is a good thing that I get my rations. I bring them to my mother, and in that way we all get something decent to eat. The days grow ever more strained, and my mother's eyes more sorrowful. 4 days left now. I must go and see Kemmerich's mother. I cannot write that down. This quaking, sobbing woman who shakes me and cries out on me, "Why are you living then when he is dead?" Who drowns me in tears and calls out, "What are you there for at all, child, when you..." Who drops into a chair and wails, "Did you see him? Did you see him then? How did he die?" I tell her he was shot through the heart and died instantaneously. She looks at me. She doubts me. "You lie. I know better. I have felt how terribly he died. I have heard his voice at night. I have felt his anguish. Tell the truth. I want to know it. I must know it." "No," I say. "I was beside him. He died at once." She pleads with me gently. "Tell me. You must tell me. I know you want to comfort me, but don't you see you torment me far more than if you told me the truth? I cannot bear the uncertainty. Tell me how it was, and even though it will be terrible, it will be far better than what I have to think if you don't." I will never tell her. She can make mincemeat out of me first. I pity her, but she strikes me as rather stupid all the same. Why doesn't she stop worrying? Kemmerich will stay dead, whether she knows about it or not. When a man has seen so many dead, he cannot understand any longer why there should be so much anguish over a single individual. So I say, rather impatiently, "He died immediately. He felt absolutely nothing at all. His face was quite calm." She is silent. Then says slowly, "Will you swear it?"
"Yes."
"By everything that is sacred to you?"
"Good God, what is there that is sacred to me? Such things change pretty quickly with us." "Yes, he died at once."
"Are you willing never to come back yourself if it isn't true?"
"May I never come back if he wasn't killed instantaneously. I would swear to anything."
But she seems to believe me. She moans and weeps steadily. I have to tell how it happened, so I invent a story, and I almost believe it myself. As I leave, she kisses me and gives me a picture of him. In his recruit's uniform, he leans on a round, rustic table with legs made of birch branches. Behind him, a wood is painted on a curtain, and on the table stands a mug of beer. It is the last evening at home. Everyone is silent. I go to bed early. I seize the pillow, press it against myself, and bury my head in it. Who knows if I will ever lie in a feather bed again? Late in the night, my mother comes into my room. She thinks I am asleep, and I pretend to be so. To talk, to stay awake with one another, it is too hard. She sits long into the night, although she is in pain and often writhes. At last I can bear it no longer and pretend I have just wakened up. "Go and sleep, Mother. You will catch cold here."
"I can sleep enough later," she says.
I sit up. "I don't go straight back to the front, Mother. I have to do 4 weeks at the training camp. I may come over from there on Sunday, perhaps." She is silent. Then she asks gently,
"Are you very much afraid?"
"No, Mother."
"I would like to tell you to be on your guard against the women out in France. They are no good."
"Ah, Mother, Mother, you still think I am a child. Why can I not put my head in your lap and weep? Why have I always to be strong and self-controlled? I would like to weep and be comforted, too. Indeed, I am little more than a child. In the wardrobe still hang short boys' trousers. It is such a little time ago. Why is it over?"
"Where we are, there aren't any women, Mother," I say as calmly as I can. "And be very careful at the front, Paul."
"Ah, Mother, Mother, why do I not take you in my arms and die with you? What poor wretches we are." "Yes, Mother, I will."
"I will pray for you every day, Paul." "Ah, Mother, Mother,
let us rise up and go out back through the years where the burden of all this misery lies on us no more, back to you and me alone, Mother. Perhaps you can get a job that is not so dangerous."
"Yes, Mother, perhaps I can get into the cookhouse. That can easily be done."
"You do it, then. And if the others say anything..."
"That won't worry me, Mother."
She sighs. Her face is a white gleam in the darkness. "Now you must go to sleep, Mother." She does not reply. I get up and wrap my cover around her shoulders. She supports herself on my arm. She is in pain. And so I take her to her room. I stay with her a little while.
"And you must get well again, Mother, before I come back."
"Yes. Yes, my child. You ought not to send your things to me, Mother. We have plenty to eat out there. You can make much better use of them here."
How destitute she lies there in her bed, she that loves me more than all the world. As I am about to leave, she says hastily, "I have 2 pairs of underpants for you. They are all wool. They will keep you warm. You must not forget to put them in your pack."
"Ah, Mother,
I know what these underpants have cost you in waiting and walking and begging. Ah, mother, mother, how can it be that I must part from you? Who else is there that has any claim on me but you? Here I sit, and there you are lying. We have so much to say, and we shall never say it. Good night, mother. Good night, my child. The room is dark. I hear my mother's breathing and the ticking of the clock. Outside the window the wind blows and the chestnut trees rustle. On the landing I stumble over my pack, which lies there already made up, because I have to leave early in the morning. I bite into my pillow. I grasp the iron rods of my bed with my fists. I ought never to have come here. Out there I was indifferent and often hopeless. I will never be able to be so again. I was a soldier. And now I am nothing but an agony for myself, for my mother, for everything that is so comfortless and without end. I ought never to have come on leave. Chapter 8. I already know the camp on the moors. It was here that Himmelstoss gave Tjaden his education. But now I know hardly anyone here. As ever, all is altered. There are only a few people that I have occasionally met before. I go through the routine mechanically. In the evenings I generally go to the soldiers' home, where the newspapers are laid out, but I do not read them. Still, there is a piano there that I am glad enough to play on. Two girls are in attendance. One of them is young. The camp is surrounded with high barbed wire fences. If we come back late from the soldiers' home, we have to show passes. But those who are on good terms with the guard can get through, of course. Among the junipers and the birch trees on the moor, we practice company drill each day. It is bearable, if one expects nothing better. We advance at a run, fling ourselves down, and our panting breath moves the stalks of the grasses and the flowers of the heather to and fro. Looked at so closely, one sees the fine sand is composed of millions of the tiniest pebbles, as clear as if they had been made in a laboratory. It is strangely inviting to dig one's hands into it. But most beautiful are the woods, with their line of birch trees. Their color changes with every minute. Now the stems gleam purest white, and between them, airy and silken, hangs the pastel green of the leaves. The next moment all changes to an opalescent blue as the shivering breezes pass down from the heights and touch the green lightly away. And again in one place it deepens almost to black as a cloud passes over the sun. And this shadow moves like a ghost through the dim trunks and rides far out over the moor to the sky. Then the birches stand out again like gay banners on white poles with their red and gold patches of autumn-tinted leaves. I often become so lost in the play of soft light and transparent shadow that I almost fail to hear the commands. It is when one is alone that one begins to observe nature and to love her. And here I have not much companionship and do not even desire it. We are too little acquainted with one another to do more than joke a bit and play poker or nap in the evenings. Alongside our camp is the big Russian prison camp. It is separated from us by a wire fence, but in spite of this the prisoners come across to us. They seem nervous and fearful, though most of them are big fellows with beards. They look like meek, scolded St. Bernard dogs. They slink about our camp and pick over the garbage tins. One can imagine what they find there. With us, food is pretty scarce, and none too good at that. Turnips cut into 6 pieces and boiled in water, and unwashed carrot tops. Moldy potatoes are titbits, and the chief luxury is a thin rice soup in which float little bits of beef sinew, but these are cut up so small that they take a lot of finding. Everything gets eaten, notwithstanding. And if ever anyone is so well off as to not want all his share, there are a dozen others standing by ready to relieve him of it. Only the dregs that the ladle cannot reach are tipped out and thrown into the garbage tins. Along with that there sometimes go a few turnip peelings, moldy bread crusts, and all kinds of muck. This thin, miserable, dirty garbage is the objective of the prisoners. They pick it out of the stinking tins greedily and go off with it under their blouses. It is strange to see these enemies of ours so close up. They have faces that make one think. Honest peasant faces, broad foreheads, broad noses, broad mouths, broad hands, and thick hair. They ought to be put to threshing, reaping, and apple picking. They look just as kindly as our own peasants in Friesland. It is distressing to watch their movements, to see them begging for something to eat. They are all rather feeble, for they only get enough nourishment to keep them from starving. Ourselves, we have not had sufficient to eat for long enough. They have dysentery. Furtively, many of them display the blood-stained tails of their shirts. Their backs, their necks are bent, their knees sag, their heads droop as they stretch out their hands and beg in the few words of German that they know, beg with those soft, deep, musical voices that are like warm stoves and cozy rooms at home. Some men there are who give them a kick so that they fall over, but those are not many. The majority do nothing to them, just ignore them. Occasionally, when they are too groveling, it makes a man mad, and then he kicks them. If only they would not look at one so. What great misery can be in two such small spots, no bigger than a man's thumb, in their eyes? They come over to the camp in the evenings and trade. They exchange whatever they possess for bread. Often they have fair success, because they have very good boots, and ours are bad. The leather of their knee-boots is wonderfully soft, like suede. The peasants among us who get titbits sent from home can afford to trade. The price of a pair of boots is about 2 or 3 loaves of army bread, or a loaf of bread and a small, tough ham sausage. But most of the Russians have long since parted with whatever things they had. Now they wear only the most pitiful clothing and try to exchange little carvings and objects that they have made out of shell fragments and copper driving bands. Of course, they don't get much for such things. Though they may have taken immense pains with them, they go for a slice or two of bread. Our peasants are hard and cunning when they bargain. They hold the piece of bread or sausage right under the nose of the Russian till he grows pale with greed and his eyes bulge, and then he will give anything for it. The peasants wrap up their booty with the utmost solemnity and then get out their big pocket knives and slowly and deliberately cut off a slice of bread for themselves from their supply, and with every mouthful take a piece of the good tough sausage and so reward themselves with a good feed. It is distressing to watch them take their afternoon meal thus. One would like to crack them over their thick pates. They rarely give anything away. How little we understand one another. I am often on guard over the Russians. In the darkness one sees their forms move like 6 storks, like great birds. They come close up to the wire fence and lean their faces against it. Their fingers hook round the mesh. Often many stand side by side and breathe the wind that comes down from the moors and the forest. They rarely speak, and then only a few words. They are more human and more brotherly towards one another, it seems to me, than we are. But perhaps that is merely because they feel themselves to be more unfortunate than us. Anyway, the war is over, so far as they are concerned. But to wait for dysentery is not much of a life either. The territorials who are in charge of them say that they were much more lively at first. They used to have intrigues among themselves, as always happens, and it would often come to blows and knives. But now they are quite apathetic and listless. Most of them do not masturbate anymore, they are so feeble, though otherwise things come to such a pass that whole huts full of them do it. They stand at the wire fence. Sometimes one goes away, and then another at once takes his place in line. Most of them are silent. Occasionally one begs a cigarette butt. I see their dark forms, their beards move in the wind. I know nothing of them, except that they are prisoners. And that is exactly what troubles me. Their life is obscure and guiltless. If I could know more of them, what their names are, how they live, what they are waiting for, what their burdens are, then my emotion would have an object and might become sympathy. But as it is, I perceive behind them only the suffering of the creature, the awful melancholy of life, and the pitilessness of men. A word of command has made these silent figures our enemies. A word of command might transform them into our friends. At some table, a document is signed by some persons whom none of us knows, and then for years together that very crime on which formerly the world's condemnation and severest penalty fall becomes our highest aim. But who can draw such a distinction when he looks at these quiet men with their childlike faces and apostles' beards? Any non-commissioned officer is more of an enemy to a recruit, any schoolmaster to a pupil, than they are to us. And yet we would shoot at them again, and they at us, if they were free. I am frightened. I dare think this way no more. This way lies the abyss. It is not now the time, but I will not lose these thoughts. I will keep them, shut them away until the war is ended. My heart beats fast. This is the aim, the great, the sole aim, that I have thought of in the trenches, that I have looked for as the only possibility of existence after this annihilation of all human feeling. This is a task that will make life afterward worthy of these hideous years. I take out my cigarettes, break each one in half, and give them to the Russians. They bow to me and then light the cigarettes. Now red points glow in every face. They comfort me. It looks as though there were little windows in dark village cottages, saying that behind them are rooms full of peace. The days go by. On a foggy morning, another of the Russians is buried. Almost every day, one of them dies. I am on guard during the burial. The prisoners sing a chorale. They sing in parts, and it sounds almost as if there were no voices, but an organ far away on the moor. The burial is quickly over. In the evening they stand again at the wire fence, and the wind comes down to them from the beech woods. The stars are cold. I now know a few of those who speak a little German. There is a musician amongst them. He says he used to be a violinist in Berlin. When he hears that I can play the piano, he fetches his violin and plays. The others sit down and lean their backs against the fence. He stands up and plays. Sometimes he has that absent expression which violinists get when they close their eyes. Or again he sways the instrument to the rhythm and smiles across to me. He plays mostly folk songs, and the others hum with him. They are like a country of dark hills that sing far down under the ground. The sound of the violin stands like a slender girl above it, and is clear and alone. The voices cease, and the violin continues alone. In the night it is so thin it sounds frozen. One must stand close up. It would be much better in a room. Out here it makes a man grow sad. Because I have already had a long leave, I get none on Sundays. So the last Sunday before I go back to the front, my father and eldest sister come over to see me. All day we sit in the soldiers' home. Where else could we go? We don't want to stay in the camp. About midday we go for a stroll on the moors. The hours are a torture. We do not know what to talk about. So we speak of my mother's illness. It is now definitely cancer. She is already in the hospital and will be operated on shortly. The doctors hope she will recover, but we have never heard of cancer being cured. Where is she, then? I ask. In the Louisa Hospital, says my father. In which class? Third, we must wait till we know what the operation costs. She wanted to be in the third herself. She said that then she would have some company, and besides, it is cheaper. So she is lying there with all those people. If only she could sleep properly. My father nods. His face is broken and full of furrows. My mother has always been sickly, and though she has only gone to the hospital when she has been compelled to, it has cost a great deal of money, and my father's life has been practically given up to it. If only I knew how much the operation costs, says he. Have you not asked? Not directly. I cannot do that. The surgeon might take it amiss, and that would not do. He must operate on Mother. Yes, I think bitterly. That's how it is with us and with all poor people. They don't dare ask the price, but worry themselves dreadfully beforehand about it. But the others, for whom it is not important, they settle the price first as a matter of course, and the doctor does not take it amiss from them. The dressings afterwards are so expensive, says my father. Doesn't the invalid's fund pay anything toward it, then? I ask. Mother has been ill too long. Have you any money at all? He shakes his head. No, but I can do some overtime. I know. He will stand at his desk, folding and pasting and cutting until 12 o'clock at night. At 8 o'clock in the evening he will eat some miserable rubbish they get in exchange for their food tickets, then he will take a powder for his headache and work on. In order to cheer him up a bit, I tell him a few stories, soldiers' jokes and the like, about generals and sergeant majors. Afterwards, I accompany them both to the railway station. They give me a pot of jam and a bag of potato cakes that my mother has made for me. Then they go off, and I return to the camp. In the evening, I spread the jam on the cakes and eat some. But I have no taste for them. So I go out to give them to the Russians. Then it occurs to me that my mother cooked them herself, and that she was probably in pain as she stood before the hot stove. I put the bag back in my pack and take only 2 cakes to the Russians. Chapter 9. We travel for several days. The first aeroplanes appear in the sky. We roll on past transport lines, guns, guns. The light railway picks us up. I search for my regiment. No one knows exactly where it lies. Somewhere or other I put up for the night. Somewhere or other I receive provisions and a few vague instructions. And so, with my pack and my rifle, I set out again on the way. By the time I come up, they are no longer in the devastated place. I hear we have become one of the flying divisions that are pushed in wherever it is hottest. That does not sound cheerful to me. They tell me of heavy losses that we have been having. I inquire after Kat and Albert. No one knows anything of them. I search farther and wander about here and there. It is a strange feeling. One night more and then another I camp out like a Red Indian. Then at last I get some definite information, and by the afternoon I am able to report to the orderly room. The sergeant major detains me there. The company comes back in 2 days' time. There is no object in sending me up now. "What was it like on leave?" he asks. "Pretty good, eh?" "In parts," I say. "Yes," He sighs. Yes, if a man didn't have to come away again. The second half is always rather messed up by that. I loaf around until the company comes back in the early morning, gray, dirty, soured, and gloomy. Then I jump up, push in amongst them, my eyes searching. There is Tjaden. There is Müller, blowing his nose. And there are Kat and Krupp. We arrange our sacks of straw side by side. I have an uneasy conscience when I look at them, and yet without any good reason. Before we turn in, I bring out the rest of the potato cakes and jam, so that they can have some, too. The outer cakes are moldy, still it is possible to eat them. I keep those for myself, and give the fresh one to Kat and Krupp. Kat chews, and says, "These are from your mother." I nod. "Good," says he. "I can tell by the taste." I could almost weep. I can hardly control myself any longer. But it will soon be all right again, back here with Kat and Albert. This is where I belong. "You've been lucky," whispers Krupp to me before we drop off to sleep. "They say we are going to Russia." To Russia? There's not much of a war over there. In the distance, the front thunders. The walls of the hut rattle. There's a great deal of polishing being done. We are inspected at every turn. Everything that is torn is exchanged for new. I score a spotless new tunic out of it, and Kat, of course, an entire outfit. A rumor is going round that there may be peace. But the other story is more likely, that we are bound for Russia. Still, what do we need new things for in Russia? At last it leaks out. The Kaiser is coming to review us. Hence all the inspections. For 8 whole days, one would suppose we were in a base camp. There was so much drill and fuss. Everyone is peevish and touchy. We do not take kindly to all this polishing, much less to the full dress parades. Such things exasperate a soldier more than the front line. At last the moment arrives. We stand to attention, and the Kaiser appears. We are curious to see what he looks like. He stalks along the line, and I am really rather disappointed. Judging from his pictures, I imagine him to be bigger and more powerfully built, and above all to have a thundering voice. He distributes iron crosses, speaks to this man and that. Then we march off. Afterwards we discuss it. Tjaden says with astonishment, "So that is the All Highest. And everyone, bar nobody, has to stand up stiff in front of him." He meditates. "Hindenburg, too, he has to stand up stiff to him, eh?"
"Sure,"
says Kat. Tjaden hasn't finished yet. He thinks for a while and then asks, "And would a king have to stand up stiff to an emperor?" None of us is quite sure about it, but we don't suppose so. They are both so exalted that standing strictly to attention is probably not insisted on.
"What rot you do hatch out," says Kat. "The main point is that you have to stand stiff yourself."
But Tjaden is quite fascinated. His otherwise prosy fancy is blowing bubbles.
"But look," he announces, "I simply can't believe that an emperor has to go through the latrine the same as I have."
"You can bet your boots on it."
"4½ wit makes 7, says Kat. "You've got a maggot in your brain, Tjaden. Just you run along to the latrine quick and get your head clear so that you don't talk like a 2-year-old.
Tjaden disappears.
"But what I would like to know," says Albert, "is whether there would not have been a war if the Kaiser had said no.
"I'm sure there would," I interject.
"He was against it from the first." "Well, if not him alone, then perhaps if 20 or 30 people in the world had said no."
"That's probable," I agree. "But they damned well said yes."
"It's queer when one thinks about it," goes on Krupp. "We are here to protect our fatherland, and the French are over there to protect their fatherland. Now who's in the right?"
"Perhaps both," say I, without believing it.
"Yes, well now," pursues Albert, and I see that he means to drive me into a corner. "But our professors and parsons and newspapers say that we are the only ones that are right, and let's hope so. But the French professors and parsons and newspapers say that the right is on their side. Now what about that?
That I don't know, I say, but whichever way it is, there's war all the same, and every month more countries coming in.
Tjaden reappears. He is still quite excited, and again joins the conversation, wondering just how a war gets started.
Mostly by one country badly offending another,
answers Albert with a slight air of superiority.
Then Tjaden pretends to be obtuse.
A country? I don't follow.
A mountain in Germany cannot offend a mountain in France, or a river, or a wood, or a field of wheat.
Are you really as stupid as that, or are you just pulling my leg?
Growls Krupp.
I don't mean that at all. One people offends the other.
Then I haven't any business here at all, replies Tjaden. I don't feel myself offended.
Well, let me tell you, says Albert sourly, it doesn't apply to tramps like you.
Then I can be going home right away, retorts Tjaden, and we all laugh.
Ach, man, he means the people as a whole, the state, exclaims Müller.
State, state,
Tjaden snaps his fingers contemptuously. Gendarmes, police, taxes, that's your state. If that's what you're talking about, no thank you.
That's right, says Kat. You've said something for once, Tjaden. State and home country, there's a big difference.
But they go together, insists Krupp. Without the state, there wouldn't be any home country.
True. But just you consider. Almost all of us are simple folk. And in France, too, the majority of men are laborers, workmen, or poor clerks. Now just why would a French blacksmith or a French shoemaker want to attack us? No, it is merely the rulers. I had never seen a Frenchman before I came here, and it will be just the same with the majority of Frenchmen as regards us. They weren't asked about it any more than we were.
Then what exactly is the war for? Asks Tjaden.
Kat shrugs his shoulders.
Yeah, there must be some people to whom the war is useful.
Well, I'm not one of them, grins Tjaden.
Not you nor anybody else here.
Who are they, then? Persists Tjaden.
It isn't any use to the Kaiser, either. He has everything he can want already.
I'm not so sure about that, contradicts Kat. He's not had a war up until now.
And every full-grown emperor requires at least one war, otherwise he would not become famous. You look in your schoolbooks.
And generals, too, adds Dietering. They become famous through war.
Even more famous than emperors, adds Kat.
There are other people back there who profit by the war, that's certain, growls Dietering.
I think it is more of a kind of fever, says Albert. No one in particular wants it, and then all at once there it is. We didn't want the war, the others say the same thing, and yet half the world is in it all the same.
But there are more lies told by the other side than by us, say I. Just think of those pamphlets the prisoners have on them, where it says that we eat Belgian children. The fellows who write those lies ought to go out and hang themselves. They are the real culprits.
Müller gets up.
Anyway, it is better that the war is here instead of in Germany. Just you look at the shell holes.
True, assents Tjaden.
But no war at all would be better still.
He is quite proud of himself, because he has scored for once over us volunteers, and his opinion is quite typical. Here one meets it time and again, and there is nothing with which one can properly counter it, because that is the limit of their comprehension of the factors involved. The national feeling of the Tommy resolves itself into this. Here he is. But that is the end of it. Everything else he criticizes from his own practical point of view.
Albert lies down on the grass and growls angrily.
The best thing is not to talk about the rotten business.
It won't make any difference, that's sure, agrees Kat.
To make matters worse, we have to return almost all the new things and take back our old rags again. The good ones were merely for the inspection. Instead of going to Russia, we go up the line again. On the way, we pass through a devastated wood with the tree trunk shattered and the ground plowed up. At several places, there are tremendous craters.
Great guns, something's hit that, I say to Kat.
Trench mortars, he replies, and then points up at one of the trees. In the branches, dead men are hanging. A naked soldier is squatting in the fork of a tree. He still has his helmet on, otherwise he is entirely unclad.
There is only half of him sitting up there, the top half. The legs are missing.
What can that mean? I ask.
He's been blown out of his clothes, mutters Chiatin.
It's funny, says Cat. We've seen that several times now. If a mortar gets you, it blows you clean out of your clothes. It's the concussion that does it.
I search around. And so it is. Here hang bits of uniform, and somewhere else is plastered a bloody mess that was once a human limb. Over there lies a body with nothing but a piece of the underpants on one leg and the collar of the tunic around its neck. Otherwise it is naked, and the clothes are hanging up in the tree. Both arms are missing, as though they had been pulled out. I discover one of them 20 yards off in a shrub. The dead man lies on his face. There, where the arm wounds are, the earth is black with blood. Underfoot, the leaves are scratched up as though the man had been kicking.
That's no joke, Cat, says I.
No more is a shell splinter in the belly, he replies, shrugging his shoulders.
But don't get tender-hearted, says Chiatin.
All this can only have happened a little while ago. The blood is still fresh. As everybody we see there is dead, we do not waste any more time, but report the affair at the next stretcher-bearer's post. After all, it is not our business to take these stretcher-bearers' jobs away from them.
A patrol has to be sent out to discover just how strongly the enemy position is manned. Since my leave, I feel a certain strange attachment to the other fellows, and so I volunteer to go with them. We agree on a plan, slip out through the wire, and then divide and creep forward separately. After a while, I find a shallow shell hole and crawl into it. From here, I peer forward. There is moderate machine gun fire. It sweeps across from all directions, not very heavy, but always sufficient to make one keep down. A parachute star shell opens out. The ground lies stark in the pale light, and then the darkness shuts down again, blacker than ever. In the trenches, we were told, there were black troops in front of us. That is nasty. It is hard to see them. They are very good at patrolling, too. And oddly enough, they are often quite stupid. For instance, both Cat and Krop were once able to shoot down a black enemy patrol because the fellows in their enthusiasm for cigarettes smoked while they were creeping about. Cat and Albert had simply to aim at the glowing ends of the cigarettes. A bomb or something lands close beside me. I have not heard it coming, and I'm terrified. At the same moment, a senseless fear takes hold of me. Here I am alone and almost helpless in the dark. Perhaps two other eyes have been watching me for a long while from another shell hole in front of me, and a bomb lies ready to blow me to pieces. I try to pull myself together. It is not my first patrol, and not a particularly risky one. But it is the first since my leave, and besides, the lie of the land is still rather strange to me. I tell myself that my alarm is absurd, that there is probably nothing at all there in the darkness watching me, otherwise they would not be firing so low. It is in vain. In whirling confusion, my thoughts hum in my brain. I hear the warning voice of my mother. I see the Russians with the flowing beards leaning against the wire fence. I have a bright picture of a canteen with stools, of a cinema in Valenciennes, tormented, terrified. In my imagination, I see the gray, implacable muzzle of a rifle which moves noiselessly before me whichever way I try to turn my head. The sweat breaks out from every pore. I still continue to lie in the shallow bowl. I look at the time. Only a few minutes have passed. My forehead is wet. The sockets of my eyes are damp. My hands tremble, and I am panting softly. It is nothing but an awful spasm of fear, a simple animal fear of poking out my head and crawling on farther. All my efforts subside like froth into the one desire to be able just to stay lying there. My limbs are glued to the earth. I make a vain attempt. They refuse to come away. I press myself down on the earth. I cannot go forward. I make up my mind to stay lying there. But immediately the wave floods over me and you, a mingled sense of shame, of remorse, and yet at the same time of security. I raise myself up a little to take a look around. My eyes burn with staring into the dark. A star shell goes up. I duck down again. I wage a wild and senseless fight. I want to get out of the hollow, and yet slide back into it again. I say, "You must. It is your comrades. It is not an idiotic command." And again, what does it matter to me? I have only one life to lose. "That is the result of all this leave," I plead in extenuation. But I cannot reassure myself. I become terribly faint. I raise myself slowly and reach forward with my arms, dragging my body after me, and then lie on the edge of the shell hole, half in and half out. There I hear sounds, and drop back. Suspicious sounds can be detected clearly, despite the noise of the artillery fire. I listen. The sound is behind me. They are our people, moving along the trench. Now I hear muffled voices. To judge by the tone, that might be Cat talking. At once a new warmth flows through me. These voices, these quiet words, these footsteps in the trench behind me recall me at a bound from the terrible loneliness and fear of death by which I had been almost destroyed. They are more to me than life, these voices. They are more than motherliness and more than fear. They are the strongest, most comforting thing there is anywhere. They are the voices of my comrades. I am no longer a shuddering speck of existence alone in the darkness. I belong to them and they to me. We all share the same fear and the same life. We are nearer than lovers, in a simpler, a harder way. I could bury my face in them, in these voices, these words that have saved me and will stand by me. Cautiously I glide out over the edge and snake my way forward. I shuffle along on all fours a bit farther. I keep track of my bearings, look around me and observe the distribution of the gunfire so as to be able to find my way back. Then I try to get in touch with the others. I am still afraid, but it is an intelligent fear, an extraordinarily heightened caution. The night is windy and the shadows flit hither and thither in the flicker of the gunfire. It reveals too little and too much. Often I pause, stock still, motionless, and always for nothing. Thus I advance a long way, and then turn back in a wide curve. I have not established touch with the others. Every yard nearer our trench fills me with confidence, and with haste, too. It would be bad to get hit now. Then a new fear lays hold of me. I can no longer remember the direction. Quiet, I squat in a shell hole and try to locate myself. More than once it has happened that some fellow has jumped joyfully into a trench, only then to discover that it was the wrong one. After a little time I listen again, but still I am not sure. The confusion of shell holes now seems so bewildering that I can no longer tell in my agitation which way I should go. Perhaps I am crawling parallel to the lines, and that might go on forever, so I crawl round once again in a wide curve. These damned rockets! They seem to burn for an hour, and a man cannot make the least movement without bringing the bullets whistling round. But there is nothing for it. I must get out. Falteringly I work my way farther. I move off over the ground like a crab, and rip my hands sorely on the jagged splinters, as sharp as razor blades. Often I think that the sky is becoming lighter on the horizon, but it may be merely my imagination. Then gradually I realize that to crawl in the right direction is a matter of life or death. A shell crashes. Almost immediately, two others. And then it begins in earnest, a bombardment. Machine guns rattle. Now there is nothing for it but to stay lying low. Apparently an attack is coming. Everywhere the rockets shoot up, unceasing. I lie huddled in a large shell hole, my legs in the water up to the belly. When the attack starts, I will let myself fall into the water with my face as deep in the mud as I can keep it without suffocating. I must pretend to be dead. Suddenly I hear the barrage lift. At once I slip down into the water, my helmet on the nape of my neck and my mouth just clear so that I can get a breath of air. I lie motionless. Somewhere something clanks. It stamps and stumbles nearer. All my nerves become taut and icy. It clatters over me and away. The first wave has passed. I have but this one shattering thought. What will you do if someone jumps into your shell hole? Swiftly I pull out my little dagger, grasp it fast, and bury it in my hand once again under the mud. If anyone jumps in here, I will go for him. It hammers in my forehead. At once stab him clean through the throat so that he cannot call out. That's the only way. He will be just as frightened as I am. When in terror we fall upon one another, then I must be first. Now our batteries are firing. A shell lands near me. That makes me savage with fury. All it needs now is to be killed by our own shells. I curse and grind my teeth in the mud. It is a raving frenzy. In the end, all I can do is groan and pray. The crash of the shells bursts in my ears. If our fellows make a counter-raid, I will be saved. I press my head against the earth and listen to the muffled thunder, like the explosions of quarrying, and raise it again to listen for the sounds on top. The machine guns rattle. I know our barbed wire entanglements are strong and almost undamaged. Parts of them are charged with a powerful electric current. The rifle fire increases. They have not broken through. They have to retreat. I sink down again, huddled, strained to the uttermost. The banging, the creeping, the clanging becomes audible. One single cry yelling amongst it all. They are raked with fire. The attack is repulsed. Already it has become somewhat lighter. Steps hasten over me. The first. Gone. Again, another. The rattle of machine guns becomes an unbroken chain. Just as I am about to turn round a little, something heavy stumbles, and with a crash a body falls over me into the shell hole, slips down, and lies across me. I do not think at all. I make no decision. I strike madly at home, and feel only how the body suddenly convulses, then becomes limp and collapses. When I recover myself, my hand is sticky and wet. The man gurgles. It sounds to me as though he bellows. Every gasping breath is like a cry, a thunder. But it is not only my heart pounding. I want to stop his mouth, stuff it with earth, stab him again. He must be quiet. He is betraying me. Now at last I regain control of myself, but have suddenly become so feeble that I cannot any more lift my hand against him. So I crawl away to the farthest corner and stay there, my eyes glued on him, my hand grasping the knife, ready, if he stirs, to spring at him again. But he won't do so any more. I can hear that already in his gurgling. I can see him indistinctly. I have but one desire, to get away. If it is not soon, it will be too light. It will be difficult enough now. Then, as I try to raise up my head, I see it is impossible already. The machine-gun fire so sweeps the ground that I should be shot through and through before I could make one jump. I test it once with my helmet, which I take off and hold up to find out the level of the shots. The next moment it is knocked out of my hand by a bullet. The fire is sweeping very low to the ground. I am not far enough from the enemy line to escape being picked off by one of the snipers if I attempt to get away. The light increases. Burning, I wait for our attack. My hands are white at the knuckles. I clench them so tightly in my longing for the fire to cease so that my comrades may come. Minute after minute trickles away. I dare not look again at the dark figure in the shell hole. With an effort, I look past it and wait, wait. The bullets hiss. They make a steel net, never ceasing, never ceasing. Then I notice my bloody hand and suddenly feel nauseated. I take some earth and rub the skin with it. Now my hand is muddy and the blood cannot be seen anymore. The fire does not diminish. It is equally heavy from both sides. Our fellows have probably given me up for lost long ago. It is early morning, clear and gray. The gurgling continues. I stop my ears, but soon take my fingers away again, because then I cannot hear the other sound. The figure opposite me moves. I shrink together and involuntarily look at it. Then my eyes remain glued to it. A man with a small pointed beard lies there. His head is fallen to one side. One arm is half bent. His head rests helplessly upon it. The other hand lies on his chest. It is bloody. He is dead, I say to myself. He must be dead. He doesn't feel anything anymore. It is only the body that is gurgling there. Then the head tries to raise itself. For a moment the groaning becomes louder. His forehead sinks back upon his arm. The man is not dead. He is dying, but he is not dead. I drag myself toward him, hesitate, support myself on my hands, creep a bit farther, wait. Again a terrible journey. At last I am beside him. Then he opens his eyes. He must have heard me, for he gazes at me with a look of utter terror. The body lies still, but in the eyes there is such an extraordinary expression of fright that for a moment I think they have power enough to carry the body off with them, hundreds of miles away with one bound. The body is still perfectly still, without a sound. The gurgle has ceased, but the eyes cry out, yell. All the life is gathered together in them for one tremendous effort to flee, gathered together there in a dreadful terror of death, of me. My legs give way, and I drop on my elbows. No, no, I whisper. The eyes follow me. I am powerless to move so long as they are there. Then his hand slips slowly from his breast. Only a little bit, it sinks just a few inches. But this movement breaks the power of the eyes. I bend forward, shake my head, and whisper, no, no, no. I raise one hand. I must show him that I want to help him. I stroke his forehead. The eyes shrink back as the hand comes. Then they lose their stare. The eyelids droop lower. The tension is past. I open his collar and place his head more comfortably. His mouth stands half open. It tries to form words. The lips are dry. My water bottle is not there. I have not brought it with me. But there is water in the mud, down at the bottom of the crater. I climb down, take out my handkerchief, spread it out, push it under, and scoop up the yellow water that strains through into the hollow of my hand. He gulps it down. I fetch some more. Then I unbutton his tunic in order to bandage him if it is possible. In any case, I must do it, so that if the fellows over there capture me, they will see that I wanted to help him, and so will not shoot me. He tries to resist, but his hand is too feeble. The shirt is stuck and will not come away. It is buttoned at the back. So there is nothing for it but to cut it open. I look for the knife and find it again. But when I begin to cut the shirt, the eyes open once more, and the cry is in them again, and the demented expression, so that I must close them, press them shut, and whisper, I want to help you, comrade. Kamerad, kamerad, kamerad. Eagerly repeating the word to make him understand. There are three stabs. My field dressing covers them. The blood runs out under it. I press it tighter. There. He groans. That is all I can do. Now we must wait. Wait. These hours. The gurgling starts again. But how slowly a man dies. For this I know, he cannot be saved. I have indeed tried to tell myself that he will be, but at noon this pretense breaks down and melts before his groans. If only I'd not lost my revolver, crawling about, I would shoot him. Stab him I cannot. By noon I am groping on the outer limits of reason. Hunger devours me. I could almost weep for something to eat. I cannot struggle against it. Again and again I fetch water for the dying man and drink some myself. This is the first time I have killed with my hands, whom I can see close at hand, whose death is my doing. Cat and Krop and Müller have experienced it already, when they have hit someone. It happens to many, in hand-to-hand fighting especially. But every gasp lays my heart bare. This dying man has time with him. He has an invisible dagger with which he stabs me. Time and my thoughts. I would give much if he would but stay alive. It is hard to lie here and to have to see and hear him. In the afternoon, about 3, he is dead. I breathe freely again, but only for a short time. Soon the silence is more unbearable than the groans. I wish the gurgling were there again, gasping, hoarse, now whistling softly and again hoarse and loud. It is mad what I do, but I must do something. I prop the dead man up again so that he lies comfortably, although he feels nothing anymore. I close his eyes. They are brown. His hair is black and a bit curly at the sides. The mouth is full and soft beneath his mustache. The nose is slightly arched, the skin brownish. It is now not so pale as it was before when he was still alive. For a moment the face seems almost healthy. Then it collapses suddenly into the strange face of the dead that I have so often seen. Strange faces, all alike. No doubt his wife still thinks of him. She does not know what has happened. He looks as if he would have often written to her. She will still be getting mail from him. Tomorrow, in a week's time, perhaps even a stray letter a month hence. She will read it, and in it he will be speaking to her. My state is getting worse. I can no longer control my thoughts. What would his wife look like? Like the little brunette on the other side of the canal? Does she belong to me now? Perhaps by this act she becomes mine. I wish Cantarek were sitting here beside me. If my mother could see me. The dead man might have had 30 more years of life if only I had impressed the way back to our trench more sharply on my memory. If only he had run 2 yards farther to the left, he might now be sitting in the trench over there and writing a fresh letter to his wife. But I will get no further that way, for that is the fate of all of us. If Kemmerich's leg had been 6 inches to the right, if Haya Vestus had bent his back 3 inches further forward. The silence spreads. I talk, and must talk. So I speak to him, and to say to him, "Comrade, I did not want to kill you. If you jumped in here again, I would not do it, if you would be sensible too. But you are only an idea to me before, an abstraction that lived in my mind and called forth its appropriate response. It was that abstraction I stabbed. But now, for the first time, I see you are a man like me. I thought of your hand grenades, of your bayonet, of your rifle. Now I see your wife and your face and our fellowship. Forgive me, comrade. We always see it too late. Why do they never tell us that you are poor devils like us, that your mothers are just as anxious as ours?
and that we have the same fear of death and the same dying and the same agony. Forgive me, comrade. How could you be my enemy? If we threw away these rifles and this uniform, you could be my brother, just like Cat and Albert. Take 20 years of my life, comrade, and stand up. Take more, for I do not know what I can even attempt to do with it now. It is quiet. The front is still, except for the crackle of rifle fire. The bullets rain over. They are not fired haphazard, but shrewdly aimed from all sides. I cannot get out. I will write to your wife, I say hastily to the dead man. I will write to her. She must hear it from me. I will tell her everything I have told you. She shall not suffer. I will help her, and your parents, too, and your child. His tunic is half open. The pocketbook is easy to find. But I hesitate to open it. In it is the book with his name. So long as I do not know his name, perhaps I may still forget him. Time will obliterate it, this picture. But his name, it is a nail that will be hammered into me and never come out again. It has the power to recall this forever. It will always come back and stand before me. Irresolutely, I take the wallet in my hand. It slips out of my hand and falls open. Some pictures and letters drop out. I gather them up and want to put them back again, but the strain I am under, the uncertainty, the hunger, the danger, these hours with the dead man have made me desperate. I want to hasten the relief, to intensify and to end the torture, as one strikes an unendurably painful hand against the trunk of a tree, regardless of everything. There are portraits of a woman and a little girl. Small amateur photographs taken against an ivy-clad wall. Along with them are letters. I take them out and try to read them. Most of it I do not understand. It is so hard to decipher, and I scarcely know any French. But each word I translate pierces me like a shot in the chest, like a stab in the chest. My brain is taxed beyond endurance. But I realize this much, that I will never dare to write to these people as I intended. Impossible. I look at the portraits once more. They are clearly not rich people. I might send them money anonymously if I earn anything later on. I seize upon that. It is at least something to hold on to. This dead man is bound up with my life. Therefore, I must do everything, promise everything in order to save myself. I swear blindly that I mean to live only for his sake and his family. With wet lips I try to placate him, and deep down in me lies the hope that I may buy myself off in this way, and perhaps even get out of this. It is a little stratagem. If only I am allowed to escape, then I will see to it. So I open the book and read slowly, Gérard Duval, compositor. With the dead man's pencil, I write the address on an envelope, then swiftly thrust everything back into his tunic. I have killed the printer Gérard Duval. I must be a printer, I think confusedly. Be a printer, printer. By afternoon, I am calmer. My fear was groundless. The name troubles me no more. The madness passes. Comrade, I say to the dead man, but I say it calmly, today you, tomorrow me. But if I come out of it, comrade, I will fight against this that has struck us both down, from you taken life and from me life also. I promise you, comrade, it shall never happen again. The sun strikes low. I am stupefied with exhaustion and hunger. Yesterday is like a fog to me. There is no hope of ever getting out of this. I fall into a doze and do not at first realize that evening is approaching. The twilight comes. It seems to me to come quickly now. 1 hour more. If it were summer, it would be 3 hours more. 1 hour more. Now suddenly I begin to tremble. Something might happen in the interval. I think no more of the dead man. He is of no consequence to me now. With one bound, the lust to live flares up again, and everything that has filled my thoughts goes down before it. Now, merely to avert any ill luck, I babble mechanically, I will fulfill everything I have promised you. But already I know that I shall not do so. Suddenly it occurs to me that my own comrades may fire on me as I creep up. They do not know I am coming. I will call out as soon as I can so that they will recognize me. I will stay lying in front of the trench until they answer me. The first star. The front remains quiet. I breathe deeply and talk to myself in my excitement. No foolishness now, Paul. Quiet, Paul, quiet. Then you will be saved, Paul. When I use my Christian name, it works as though someone else spoke to me. It has more power. The darkness grows. My excitement subsides. I wait cautiously until the first rocket goes up. Then I crawl out of the shell hole. I have forgotten the dead man. Before me lies the oncoming night and the pale, gleaming field. I fix my eyes on a shell hole. The moment the light dies, I scurry over into it, grope farther, spring into the next, duck down, scramble onward. I come nearer. There, by the light of the rocket, I see something move in the wire. Then it stiffens, and I lie still. Next time I see it again. Yes, they are men from our trench. But I am suspicious until I recognize our helmets. Then I call. And immediately an answer rings out. My name. Paul? Paul! I call again in answer. It is Cat and Albert who have come out with a stretcher to look for me. Are you wounded? No, no. We drop into the trench. I ask for something to eat and wolf it down. Müller gives me a cigarette. In a few words I tell what happened. There is nothing new about it. It happens quite often. The night attack is the only unusual feature of the business. In Russia, Cat once lay for 2 days behind the enemy lines before he could make his way back. I do not mention the dead printer. But by next morning I can keep it to myself no longer. I must tell Cat and Albert. They both try to calm me. You can't do anything about it. What else could you have done? That is what you are here for. I listen to them and feel comforted, reassured by their presence. It was mere driveling nonsense that I talked out there in the shell hole. Look there, for instance, points Cat. On the fire step stand some snipers. They rest their rifles with telescopic sights on the parapet and watch the enemy front. Once and again a shot cracks out. Then we hear the cry, "That's found a billet. Did you see how he leapt in the air?" Sergeant Ulrich turns round proudly and scores his point. He heads the shooting list for today, with 3 unquestionable hits. "What do you say to that?" asks Cat. I nod. "If he keeps that up, he will get a little colored bird for his buttonhole by this evening," says Albert. "Or rather, he will soon be made acting sergeant major," says Cat. We look at one another. "I would not do it," I say. "All the same," says Cat, "it's very good for you to see it just now." Sergeant Ulrich returns to the fire step. The muzzle of his rifle searches to and fro. "You don't need to lose any sleep over your affair," nods Albert. "And now I hardly understand it myself anymore. It was only because I had to lie there with him so long," I say. "After all, war is war." Ulrich's rifle cracks out, sharply and dry.